Ryan.
How you doing?
Oh, Rachel, I'm having a bit of a strife. Oh, boy, a whole day of it. Oh, brother. We all can relate, can't we? We've all had that one day where we've had what is about 18 plot lines worth of drama happening.
Oh, boy.
Oh, man, what a...
When it's just jam-packed, but... You don't really, like, feel how busy it is.
Until you have the meeting at the end?
Yeah.
Oh, man. And don't you, like, hate meetings, Rachel?
When
you have your teacher, you hate meetings. That's how you end your school days sometimes, right? And then you come home to me and say, brother, oh, buddy, oh, pal of mine, Ryan, and husband and co-host, I had a hectic day at school. There was all of these shenanigans going on, but then I had to have a meeting. Oh, I wish I could pull out a gun like Sheridan does in his meetings, but I can't be that kind of gung-ho, devil-may-care type. Rachel says this to me all the time. Don't you, Rachel?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I do.
Hear that, Rachel? Students who listen to the pod, maybe, probably? That's the behind the scenes of what goes on when she's not around. Wishes that she could just go full cowboy like Sheridan. But no, in all seriousness, I'm doing very well. I'm here to talk B5 with you, and I am in the zone, Rachel. Season 3 is clicking so nicely. We have had a string of decent episodes. I mean, the second episode was okay, but here we are today to discuss the third one. And of course, for those uninitiated, unknown, they don't know our podcast, could you go through the rundown of who we are and what we do here?
This particular podcast that you have decided to engage with your listening ears. It's a science fiction rewatch podcast. And we are making our way through the 90s classic Babylon 5. And we are in just the beginnings of season 3. So spoilers abound.
Yes, we are looking at it from that rewatch point of view. So that means we are going to discuss it all. Not just what happened in this episode,
no,
but what happens in the future of the series, the franchise.
And
so
you
should give the show a watch. Yes.
The other point.
The more important point, yeah.
Is you may go, why is it got yum yum in the title if it doesn't have anything to do with food?
Well, Jakar did say good eating to you, so technically it all ties together nicely.
But not in this episode. He didn't say it in this episode.
I can't believe it's his catchphrase. He says it like in every episode, and I can't believe he didn't say it.
No.
So uncharacteristic.
I know. It should have been his farewell greeting to Garibaldi.
Yeah.
No.
Good eating, Mr. Garibaldi.
Yum is a homage to the line from Star Trek Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
A character in the season 2 finale.
Character.
By the minimum of the definition, Commander Nandi. Ex-engineer.
they don't remember that. This Discovery, they've completely forgot that that was her background.
Everybody's an engineer in Discovery. But no, she's asked if she wants to go off and murder the series, the season-long
antagonist. I wish that she would kill the protagonist, Michael. I know, you slip the tongue with that a lot. Mm-hmm. You just want Nan to go down on Michael in many ways. Read the fix, people. It's probably out there. Yum Yum generated a lot of minutia. You know what I like about naming our podcast Yum Yum is we break down Discovery and Babylon 5 with a very critical and analytical lens. People may disagree with us, they may agree with us, they may respect us, they may disrespect us, whatever the case may be. But when people have to discuss our podcast, they have to say Yum Yum Podcast. And that's just very amusing that people have to say it in an air of having a straight face whilst also like internally having to process that they are in fact saying yum yum podcast in a sentence. And that's absurd. Just as absurd as that line of dialogue. But we aren't here to talk absurdities. We are here to talk about a very serious episode of Babylon 5, Season 3, Episode 3, A Day in the Strife.
Yes.
What does the DVD description have to say about this? Because we have the DVDs. The physical media is ever so important because you get the morphing menus, you get the special features, and you get the DVD booklets which tell you the information of the episodes. What does this one have to say?
Anything can happen on the station, and just about everything does, as events ranging from freighter problems to non-intrigue to V's reassignment to a mysterious alien probe sweeping through the station.
Captain, you all right?
Oh, nuts.
What's wrong? I mean, we survived.
Right. Which means now I have to go back to that stupid Transport Association meeting.
Everything is happening. A Day in the Strife. To go into the history of it, I, of course, like this episode. I have always enjoyed it. What sticks out to me from that first viewing was them confronting Franklin's addiction problems, because
it's just been sitting there building.
It's just been sitting there building, 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 rising, rising, rising. But I wasn't too sure, when I was going through it that first time, if the show was actually going to address it. Because you've seen this type of thing in a lot of these shows. The doctor who works themselves to near death, but hey, they just have that conversation where they say, Doc, you haven't been sleeping lately. I order you to go to sleep, and then that's the end of it. Because doctors are noble, and they bend themselves over backwards to save lives, and that's just a given that they hurt themselves to do that in narratives and in way real life as well, that they work these brutal hours and they have to fill in this, and it's not an easy job. And in sci-fi ensemble shows, I am not used to them digging into it more about the ramifications and the fallout of a character like Dr. Franklin going through what he does with the addiction being added to it, and them actually saying out loud what it is and not beating around the bush. So that is what I remembered from my first viewing, as well as Nafar. Nafar as this new non-representative making some interesting and thought-provoking arguments about the stuff going on back home for Jakar and how Jakar's actions here are impacting back there. Because it was a thing that I thought about in Season 2 when they stripped Jakar of his ambassadorship of, well, who's going to replace Jakar? Because somebody has to replace Jakar at some point.
They won't just let him lead the Nan on Babylon 5.
They have to have a Centauri approved person. And I didn't even know if they were going to get a Nan or just Londo was going to take reign of that on Babylon 5. So that's kind of been my dynamic. What about you? A Day in the Strife.
I always forget that everything that's in this episode is everything in this episode, because there is so much that happens and so many plots and scenes that I reflect really fondly upon. And I'm like, oh, wait, all of these are here.
Yeah.
In this neat little package, some of them better than others, but I've always enjoyed this episode.
It is one that tells you what the show can be, because we rarely have had an episode of B5 with so many plots happening at the same time. We've had ones with multiple plots happening at the same time, but
balanced. Well.
This has 4 to 5 plots happening. Each one of them is given the weight and time needed to nurture them without it coming across as them being underbaked or you scratching your head at why they are here. There are obviously ones you gravitate towards to more than others, but yeah, this is demonstrating something we'll see be a further pattern in the structure of episodes, where there will be more
stuff will be going on at the same time.
Right. And that is something we just are so used to now in prestige television, where, what was it, Game of Thrones? They would have 12 plots happening in every episode, and you just took it because that's how the nature of the beast is. At this point in the landscape of TV, I guess this stuff was more regulated to soap operas or your prestige soap operas, like your Knots Landing or Dallas or Twin Peaks would often have multiple storylines going at the same time within a 45 minutes. But within the sci-fi TV landscape, where you have your Babylon 5 and you have your Star Trek and Battlestar Galactica, you usually had your A-B plot episodes or your A-plot episodes, which we have seen in B5 a lot. And obviously you'd have ones where you have a little C-plot, but this has A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H-I-J-K, L-M-N-O-P, U-R-S, T-U-V, W-X-Y-Z. I never miss out anything. Not one time. I had to say it. I'm sorry, Rachel. I had to say it. Once you start the alphabet, you can't stop the alphabet.
What could be easier? It's all alphabetical. You just put it in the right file according to alphabetical order. You know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, Z! Huh? That's all you have to do!
Very good. You know your alphabet.
Let's start off with, let's say, maybe diplomatically, the least good plot of this episode.
It frames the rest of them, though.
It does. It does the job. It's a coat hanger of a plot.
Mm-hmm.
Serves a function, and it lets these other more pretty things hang off it.
Okay, so?
Which is the probe.
The probe.
The probe.
Well, let's rewind and go with Sheridan and how it is his plot. He figures things out, and how we begin the episode with Sheridan in a, is it right to say, dark place?
You are entering my dark place.
He doesn't seem
jazzed.
Very stable.
Right, right.
Like, he's on edge, frustrated with bureaucracy. It's just like, I am tired of playing by the fucking rules. This isn't getting us anywhere. We are going around in circles, and he, like, the specific situation that he's in is that, like, they're like, okay, we're going to do more thorough searches for weapons.
Mm-hmm.
But it's causing all of these delays, so everybody's really unhappy.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, we can cut those times down, but we would have to increase the prices. So they're very unhappy with either way.
And just to preface it, Ivanov is the one engaging with them in dialogue and discussion and saying all of this. Sheridan's just got his arms crossed, pouting. Just furious that he's having to do any of this and completely disengaged.
Well, he would love for this to be Ivanov's problem.
He would love, yeah, because he hates his job. He hates his job. A large thrust of this plot is characters realizing that Sheridan is over the honeymoon phase of pretending or trying and going out of his way to play by the Babylon 5 rule book of how to operate. He is now forcing the way to do things the way he used to do them when he was a soldier, when he was in the war, or when he was commander of Agamemnon.
Yeah. If somebody challenges your authority,
you ridge up at them and mm-hmm. you have a go. And he's trying to manage the station the way he is comfortable managing things. But is that the way to do it? Is the question at play here. But yeah, he's over that honeymoon phase of like, being nice and smiley and trying and grinding and bending over backwards. He's no longer trying to
even pretend the little bit that he did that he was a bureaucrat. He can't muster it anymore.
He can't even put on the face. He's frowning. He's visibly pissed off. He's so immature. The opening is what I call the antithesis of Sinclair. Sinclair would never have done this.
Even when he was going through his death wish phase.
He respected the mantra of B5 way more. And if he did reach this, we would have had seasons of deconstructing his beliefs of the Babylon 5 mission statement. Sinclair believed in it. Sheridan never has. Sheridan may believe on it in principle, but he hasn't actually strived to do it as strongly. He's begrudgingly done it. He's gritted his teeth and clenched his jaw and bitten the bullet of bureaucracy. Sinclair would openly embrace it and find the loopholes and the shortcomings of it and work it in his favor. And he respected the plights of the dockers and of the guilds and of these people that Sheridan does not. Sheridan sees them as a problem because in his world of being the soldier man, anything that is stopping you from achieving the mission is a problem that needs to be solved. And this is, you know, he's doing the mission and these are people stopping him. So let's solve this problem through aggression and through big dick energy. I'll just whip out my dick and do this whole little game with the gun. And I will grab this PPG and give it to the guy. And I'll take his weapon and threaten him and convince him to try and shoot me. But I'm really emasculating him in front of everyone to undermine the point being made. Even though the guy makes somewhat compelling points where it is obviously you don't want Babylon 5 to have people with guns on it walking around.
Like that part not so believable. The part of like it's all well and good for Sheridan to be up there and separate and say that this is what needs to be done. It's very different for the people who are experiencing it.
Yeah, and Sheridan hasn't tried to relate to these people of B5 ever. We've never seen him openly reach out his hand like Sinclair did. So they don't respect him any, and they see him as just the jarhead. That's his image. That's why he was chosen to be B5, the leader of Babylon 5, because he has this perceived image of the soldier man, but he's more than that. But not everyone knows that, and not everyone can see that. And so what did you think of that opener?
I remember being really thrown off by it on the first watch. Like, what the fuck is he doing? Why is he being so unhinged?
Mm.
And I don't get that sense anymore. I'm like, yeah, he's been fed up for a while. And his near-death experience did not lend him any more towards bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. If anything, like finding the secrets out about the Vorlons and some more information about the Shadows has made him so much more restless.
The incident with the Centauri non-aggression pact has really broken his whatever little faith he had in hierarchy and playing the game of politics, it broke that. And I've always found it just a little too much of a writer coming in saying, wouldn't this be fun if I had this little scene? And not really looking at how much of a prick it makes Sheridan come across, because I think it's supposed to make him come across as cool.
Yeah.
He's supposed to be, and we discussed this in, what was it, There All the Honor Lies? I do believe the one where he shot them in Bari. And there's always that debate of, like, does the show recognize how crap Sheridan is? Like, what a gross man he can be, because he is a military leader who has authority over others, isn't afraid to use violence to solve the solution. And is he cool? Like, are we supposed to find him cool and awesome?
And are we cool with what he does?
And this opener, I feel I am not cool with him doing this. I do not like it. I think it's amusing, but realistically, it unnerves me. I find it unsettling. I find it deeply disrespectful of anything anyone has to argue against Sheridan, because he'll just go full cowboy mode on them and just win because he's being really unpredictable and bizarre. And it just comes across as Jameis cracking his knuckles, being like, I'm writing a fun protagonist who does wild things, and you laugh and smile because don't you kind of wish that you could do this? And I guess there is a minor part of that there for me, but I don't know. I just think that this is one of those moments where it could be a novel idea for you as a writer, but it puts dirt on the character that I don't think is supposed to stay. And I don't think it does. I think we just move past it, and Sheridan is just golly gee Sheridan, and he goes on more warring adventures where he's the right man for the job, and he's the right guy in the right place.
At the right time.
Mm-hmm. The probe plot is, let's be generous and say it works the first time round, and has diminishing returns every single time. Because when I first viewed it, I liked it. I found it engaging. I found it thrilling. I like this sci-fi, dare I say, Star Trekian plot, where you have a device that's come aboard. They're going to have to do the thing where they exchange information. And, oh, wouldn't you know it, there's a little twist to it where it's actually a weapon. And, oh, there's more twists to it where it's actually, they're going to wipe them out if they are too smart. And Sheridan figures it out right before the thing explodes. And he plays fast and loose, like how he's been wanting to throughout the whole series. And I found it riveting in that pulp science fiction way. And that's the key word, pulp. It isn't novel. It isn't unique. And I don't mean this to be a disrespectful comment, but it feels like a Larry Dottilio idea. Where Larry Dottilio in Babylon 5 would have those kind of more...
Why, thank you.
Thank you. Oh, Larry, you came back. You came back. I thought we... Oh, he's gone again. How do you come at it?
Yeah, I think that that's a good way to explain it, because it does not get better. It does get worse each time you watch it. And you're like, oh, yeah, they do this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, oh, boy, we're going back to that again? Yeah, I guess what. We have to go back to that again, but can we not?
There's cute little character moments, especially between Ivanova and Corwin.
I do not begrudge it for the Corwin stuff.
If I live through this job without completely losing my mind, it will be a miracle of biblical proportions.
Well, there goes my faith in the Almighty.
It is diminishing returns because there isn't enough kinks in the story to make it that fascinating on those revisits. And sometimes that happens with main plots of something like a Star Trek, where there are some episodes of these type of shows where they have the setup,
plot, no theme, and it just...
Yes.
It just means that it isn't juicy enough for you on the rewatch.
Here's an example from TNG I think about a lot. There is the episode where Picard meets up with the Yamato, which is the sister ship to the Enterprise, and it explodes. And they have to solve why it exploded. And, oh, wouldn't you know, it had this virus from this alien race. And then they have to go down here and there's the Romulans. And it's very, very typical TNG. And it engages you on that first watch. But after you've watched it that one time and you revisit that episode, I'm just flagging this one up as an example. There's many like this. You know how... Like, you know why
you know the
Yamato,
mystery.
You know the mystery, and you know how they solve it, and there just isn't enough of a journey in the interim. There isn't enough characterful moments. There isn't enough, as you said, themes being explored. It is just, oh, that was a neat idea. And sometimes the neat idea of a plot, whether it be a book, whether it be a movie, whether it be a television show, sometimes there is a one and done nature to it. Just that is the case. I think we strive and yearn for everything to be rewatchable or we can come back and read it again. But honestly, there are just sometimes where you can go, yeah, that Agatha Christie was a one-time read.
Which is what pulp is designed to do.
Right, and so it comes back to this being pulp sci-fi, where it's serviceable, it sustains itself, it isn't stupid, it isn't brilliant, but it does the thing, and it frames everything else going on. It gives an underlying tension to all of the other plots. It helps push Stephen's anxiety and anger and arrogance. It pushes Garibaldi to visit all of these people. It is a thing that motivates the emotions and the dramas of the other plots we are watching. And it also is a part of the gimmick of this episode, which is it all takes place in one day. Hence, a day in the strife. So we begin the episode, we'll adjourn the meeting, and we'll meet again tomorrow. And oh, by the end of the episode, we wrap it up. We tie the bow with the meeting again. We did it. We got to the meeting. Damn it, I wish the probe did blow up, because now I have to face a meeting. Oh, brother. We can all relate to that, Sheridan. The thing I thoroughly remembered from this was Franklin's addiction. Mm-hmm. And I still like it as a story.
Yeah.
That doesn't diminish on return for me. No. In fact, it gets more impactful and more emotionally gripping, and I'm noticing more details or appreciating the finer things here.
Such as?
Richard Biggs' performance is
stellar.
I think I asked this when he first showed up in B5, but is he the best human, like out of our human cast, is he the best actor? Like out of like the Earth Force crew, is he the one that just nails it the most? Because honestly,
yeah. I'm finding it hard to disagree with that as a statement. Like, because there are moments where Claudia kicks it.
Yeah.
She rocks it.
But she took a little while to find the character.
Yeah, and Garibaldi
Same. Jerry Doyle took a while to find his feet, and sometimes he drops the ball even in later seasons.
Yes, that was where I was going to go more so with Jerry. And then Bruce, like,
he's probably equal. Like, he's excellent throughout.
Yeah.
He's very under. I think he doesn't get enough praise. I mean, we've said it. He's stuck with being the protagonist man, but he does it with such ease, and he makes it seem effortless. And you know it isn't. I mean, they work in long hours.
No,
and,
but you do have those moments where the man shines through the character, and like when we were talking about the speech, when he's rehearsing it, the apology speech.
You can tell Bruce is enjoying it.
You see Bruce. I cannot think of a moment where I see Richard.
Yeah.
Not Franklin.
Bruce and Richard, the things about them is they are always great at their role. At the worst is when they're just given bad material, but they are still good. Like, as bad as The Long Dark is, I don't think Richard Biggs gives a bad performance in it. Unlike in TKO with Jerry Doyle for Garibaldi, where it's like the material's bad and he's not good either. And same with Jerry Doyle and Survivors, with material's bad and he's not good either.
No.
I just was looking at that where I'm seeing his reactions to Garibaldi's questioning of him and the expression on his face and the little movements in his eyes of, yeah, I just thought Richard Biggs really carried this. And
all levels of physicality are utilized in a subtle way. Like, you see the look in his eyes, the way that his body language kind of shifts immediately to show that he's taken aback, and then
he's taken stims.
Yeah. I'm thinking of the confrontation over dinner scene. Like, the way that he adjusts himself, and then sort of throughout the scene goes back and forth between being on edge and not, when he's like, am I allowed to be annoyed by this? Mm-hmm. Like, is he overstepping the bounds? And then when he crosses that line and trying to be more at ease again, but they're both ridged up. It's just like those are subtleties that you only get with a really good performer.
And the direction paired with it. As somebody who is trained in acting, and I look at actors as do you when we watch media and we do our whole spotlight section,
yeah,
there are these little things that are hard to communicate, mm-hmm, but you can but we notice them and they give us this like
appreciation.
Yeah, and we are seeing the actors work in a way that is nuanced and subtle. So when Franklin goes over the line, he says this horrible thing to Garibaldi about how it's not his fault, like it's not Franklin's fault that it's Garibaldi hasn't met a bottle he doesn't like, and that Garibaldi's bringing his own personal things and putting it onto Franklin. The combination of the acting and direction here of Biggs as Franklin waits that right amount of time, yeah, to go through the process of, I shouldn't have said that, and then apologize.
I can't take that back.
Yes, but it doesn't wait too long. So
I'm not going to make this better, but I need to not make this worse.
He doesn't wait too long to make it come across as disingenuous, and he doesn't come at it too quickly to make it feel as an abrupt and false apology. There's enough waiting room there for the actor to play around with the internal reaction and regret, yeah, and then the words, because it's easy to focus on how actors say dialogue.
Yeah.
How the actors deliver lines. That's why we all love Peter Jurasik as an actor here, because he says funny lines really well. But as we've said with Peter, mm-hmm, Jurasik, and it's same with Richard Biggs and Jerry Doyle, all of them, it's the quiet, it's the silence, it's the reactions, it's the acting,
yep,
when nobody is looking at you. They are
and
still reacting.
And when they're
reacting,
waiting to say their lines as well.
Yes, it's reacting and being in the moment, not just waiting for your turn to talk.
You are still being the person, the character, when you aren't the one that's talking.
When we open up and we're at Earhart's, and you know it's Earhart's because we have swing music play.
Oh, and that external establishing shot.
The one they keep using for Earhart's.
Yeah, and I'm like,
one. They only made one because they barely go to Earhart's.
We're in for a treat, aren't we? It's always a great sign when we're in Earhart's.
I don't know what it is, but they make Richard Biggs look like absolute garbage a lot in this show, like because his character's so tired, and I don't know how to say it, where he looks great. Every time they make him look like really tired, I believe it. Where I go,
yeah,
when he says, I've been up for 20 hours without a break, I'm like, yeah, man, I can see it right on you.
I feel it.
It's
I
not,
feel it on you too.
It's not
like that grime,
yes,
that you get when you've been up too long.
And again, it's not just the makeup. You feel it through the performance, where the way he's slouching, his eyes, the cheeks, just everything about his physicality is just telling you what you need. And then obviously he gets to flip it around when he comes back from the bathroom and he's clearly taken drugs and he's all energized. There is an argument to be made that he overdoes it there, but as somebody who has seen that happen in real life, that type of somebody goes off and then they come back manic like that after taking a substance, it's like, yeah, I mean,
especially
I've seen it be as obvious,
yeah,
as that. I mean, it is that type,
yeah,
of thing. So I'm not going to fault him. And
no, I'm like, yeah. That is what it really can be like when somebody, you're like, oh, they really did go to the bathroom, mm-hmm, and snorted some cocaine and now they're back.
Yeah, or take a pill or something.
Yeah.
A cute piece of behind-the-scenes information about this scene is the woman that is eyeing off Dr. Franklin that he does end up dancing with is was Richard Biggs' wife. So that's cute. She got the, you know, that's all she gets. That she's just in the show. She shares this nice, cute little moment there. And I always adore reading that. I mean, you know, it's just a cute little thing.
Sweet.
It's sweet. It's sweet. And yeah, it's a sweet thing to think about in a rather depressing storyline.
Yeah.
Because the storyline is depressing. It's sad. It's not happy.
No.
But to just read that little trivia point, it brings a smile to my face in a plot line that makes me deeply uncomfortable.
Look back at Earhart's. Between the time you went off to the bathroom and you came back, did you do any stims?
Stims are perfectly legal, used by prescription in moderation.
That's not what I asked you. Did you do any stims?
All right, yeah. I mean, what of it?
Steven.
No, wait a minute now. You know, most days I'm on duty 36 hours at a stretch, sometimes longer. Because we don't have the people or the resources or the money. No, I have to be alert and I have to be focused or people die. It's that simple.
Look, I don't want to butt into your personal life.
It's a little late for that now, isn't it?
This is the other thing, too, is we get told a lot about how much he's under the grind. And we've seen it with episodes like Confessions and Lamentations or when the Centauri-Narn War was on.
Yes.
But now all of those things are done.
Mm-hmm.
A part of you thinks, well,
things would be a bit calmer, right?
Nope. What did you think about all of this stuff with him having to deal with this alien he doesn't understand the language of, and then all the stuff regarding the probe and how he is struggling not to take the stims because he doesn't see it as a problem. He is the addict who is refusing to admit that they have a problem.
It's a tool. I can get through it without it. I don't need it. The denial of the need allows for the denial of the addiction, right?
Yeah.
And it's infuriating to watch because you feel him itching for it before he even opens that drawer. And you know that he's going to cave.
Right.
You know that he's not at the point where he can say no. And it's heartbreaking to watch every time because you know how far he falls.
He flies off the handle.
Yeah.
Many times to the point in which where, and this is where you yumlings out there, the people listening, you can let us know if you agree or disagree, but when he goes full Hulk mode at that woman back on Earth, he's justified to me. That is justified rage. But because Franklin
of character.
It's not, well, that's the thing. Because Franklin has flown off the handle so much, it's a pattern that people are beginning to see. And so when they see it as heightened as it is here, it's worrying, even if it is something that they have seen. Because I would say, if anything, it isn't unusual anymore. They see this of Franklin, but his justifiable rage no longer feels justifiable from the people around him and to us, the viewer, because we've seen it be unjustified. We've seen him do it through the emotion and withdrawals of stims. So him going full General Franklin mode, that's the other thing. I love how much he comes across like his dad here. He's like, I need it now, and if you don't do it, I'm going to get you disbarred, and you'll leave nothing but a skid mark on your way out of here, missy. He's his dad. He's his fucking dad.
Yeah, he leans into that.
He really leans into it. And again, acting is very difficult. You have to do that scene multiple times.
Yeah.
And I love how he plays it where you are in the moment. It's that you're in the momentum of it. You are with him in the rage where you go, yeah, you fucking idiot. But also you are deeply aware of how unhealthy he is.
Yeah. You really are led to pause when he looks up and he realizes how everybody's looking at him. And that kind of like, oh, fuck.
And then that pushes him to do the stims.
Like, yep. Like, I can't go any further.
It's Franklin. He, I realize that there are people who don't like Franklin. And I think a large part of it is in your science fiction show, you're wanting your characters to lean in more to certain trappings and motifs and ideas of the genre. Where you, Sheridan, he is the military man, but he becomes like this savior figure for the galaxy, and he tells the bad guys to get the hell out of my galaxy. Yeah. And you have Londo, who's this fun alien, and he's a war criminal, and he does all these things that and so on and so forth. But Franklin doesn't engage with that as much, where you could have this exact same plot in a medical drama.
Yeah.
This is something that House deals with, basically, right? Where House is a drug addict and it comes to a boiling point and people have to get up his ass about it and he'll fall back into it and back and forth and medical dilemmas. And that is something that could be unwelcome for people in their show where they are here for space politics. But to me, it is something that I find grounding. Because Babylon 5 isn't just a sci-fi show. It tackles many themes, many genres as well.
And to that point, there's something that I want to tie that into, I guess, is Babylon 5, in a lot of its moments, in a lot of its substance, reaffirms that the problems of humans and the problems of humanity do not go away when we go into space.
Yeah.
So the idea of addiction still being a problem really works for me.
It really works for me. And that heartbreak you have when he lies at the end. And there is no excuse anymore because Franklin's been fooling himself.
Mm-hmm.
No one's confronted him directly. We've had Dr. Lazarin saying, you're taking too many. But it was, again, there was a internal justification for it. And throughout this, there's internal, external justifications for his actions that we believe because we have seen the universe of this show where Franklin is under the grind, there's not enough staff. Capitalism exists where you have to pay this and do this.
Yeah.
Lives exist. All of this we understand because we've seen it in the show. Mm-hmm. We've seen how this capitalist system runs and how it forces people to do these things, how it forces them and motivates them to tear themselves apart to do their jobs, and that there aren't enough people, and that Babylon 5 is this place of great struggle. So everything Franklin has done has an understandable...
We know why.
It is understandable and we get it. But then Garibaldi brings doubt into it where he goes, there are those shifts that you take that you don't need to take. You take them because you think you need to take them. And then he doesn't admit that he's a drug addict. And of course, as a viewer, that is the telltale sign that, yeah, you are clearly a drug addict. And I've seen this, but he's still fooling himself. He's like, I don't need to take it. It is that. And he challenges himself throughout the episode, but then he succumbs to it. But that doesn't come across as the guilt moment for him. He's like, it's the relief moment. The guilt, the time where he can no longer wholeheartedly with a clean conscience say that he isn't an addict is when he brags to Garibaldi at the end that he didn't take any during any of this. And you see the reaction. You see him turn his head because he can't even live with that lie. He can't look Garibaldi straight in the eyes and maintain it.
Garibaldi, I just don't think he believes it either. Like, he wants to believe that Franklin isn't lying.
He wants to believe in the best of people until they prove him wrong.
The doubt that comes through the facial expressions of Jerry Doyle in that scene is just subtle enough that I think you can read it either way.
Listen, I want to say I may have jumped the gun a little when we talked. I had no business getting in your face about the stems. You say you got it covered, that's your call.
Thank you. And I do have it covered. I do. I mean, I went through this whole nonsense with the probe and about a half a dozen sick patients, and I never touched the stuff once.
Oh, man. heavy episode. A lot of things going on. There's a lot of moving pieces. And then we have Londo. And anytime you have Londo in an episode, it just adds more layers and
so
more drama.
Sad.
I
find him so sad in this episode, but I have no pity for him.
I flag this one up as one of the times, like, Londo, if we had to make a top 10 Londo despicable moments list, this is in my top three.
Oh,
him talking to Nafar.
Yeah, abso-fucking-lutely.
It's probably the most disgusting, vile, despicable, soulless, cruel thing
I've
ever seen him
do. And the justification to veer after is so necessary for the, just the, oh, I can't even think of the right word because it just is like that creepy shiver sort of up your spine moment of being so disgusted and appalled, but it's somebody that you do kind of care about still, and you're like, why? You feel for Veer so much.
Nafar is the new Narn representative, and he has to report to Londo to be able to allow to get the permission to talk to Jakar, which says it all. And Londo is reveling in being this guy's master, being this guy's owner.
Yep.
We haven't seen Londo engage with the Narn really since his visit to Narn. We've seen him talk to Jakar, but that's different. Jakar is this rival to him, but he can't do anything to Jakar. Jakar's untouchable. He can't do anything. But this guy is in his grip, and he can squeeze him all he likes, and he can toy with him, humiliate him, break him. And the fact that he can do that says everything, but the fact that he does do that is what's really damning about him, because as much as you want to like Londo, this is what he wants. This is what he's always wanted, to do this. To do what he's doing is what he's wanted to
do. Yeah, yeah, it is.
To flex, to be important, and to be important is to conquer and rule over another to him. That's what he thinks is that, and it's just...
That's what power means to him, and he wants power.
And he's always said this. Yeah. From the pilot, he's said that this moment is what he's wanted.
Yep.
And we see it, and it's despicable. It's gross. It's always been gross and despicable, but Londo's been this down-and-out character, this funny guy, this sad clown with retrospective qualities and introspection and nuances. But here, we only see the 2D villain that he wants to be. And that's the key, is he wants to be this, but he can't fully be this. Hence, he does what we get the plot line being, which is him removing his soul, which is Veer.
Yep, his last shred of a conscience.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I just want to keep talking about the Nafar scene. What do you think? I mean, do you remember how you felt about it that first time round and what it made your dynamic to Londo be?
I don't remember it distinctly. I feel like it would have had me sticking my fingers in my ears and being like, not my Londo! Because I didn't want to be that disgusted by a character that I enjoyed. I wanted him to go back to being Fun Londo. I want season one Londo back! I imagine that being my kind of reaction, because I'm still just like, damn it. Damn it, that last little bit of fucking hope. You had to squash it. You had to squash it. And it's just a kind of everyday devastation that he does it. Because you know that this is very acceptable to him. Mm. What
it's expected.
His government would expect of him.
Yeah, it's the mask he has to put on.
Yes.
And he gladly, it seems, puts it on. But there is reservations.
Yes.
I remember vividly this was the moment where I was team fuck you, Londo. Because before then, there was humanity to him. There was nuances. And yes, what he did in the council chambers to Jakar was gross and horrid. But I had seen his face at the bombing of Narn. And I'd seen his face at the end of that episode realizing that the He has regrets, but here it was.
This decision is all up to him. How he engages with this is all up to him.
Yeah.
And he chooses the despicable option.
And it wasn't just it's a despicable thing. It's it's the straw that broke the camel's back, because it is a multitude of things from before. And this was just the one way across the line of me wholeheartedly or even in a reserved fashion supporting the character in a way where I wanted things to work out for them. I wanted him to get it. I wanted him to get punished. I wanted him to get the bad thing.
He needs to pay for this.
Yes, pay for what he's doing. This was the line. And JMS will take Londo to the places we know him to go. And they're good places in terms of narratively. They are satisfying and deeply upsetting as well. And this was such a harrowing scene. And it's so quiet. The way Londo's a loud character, and yet he's so dry and smiley.
Measured.
And the executions nafar, they continue. And he nods. Progress. Just, he is the grossest man in existence. And Nafar, the way he's played is so brilliant, where he is having to bite his tongue. He's having to suppress all of his urges to kill this man because he has to do the thing for his people.
Or even just to talk back to him in any way.
He has to control, and he has that pride that Londo speaks of. You can see it in his eyes, like how Londo says. And he does have his little jabs. Yeah, the remaining streets, the surviving streets, and yes, they continue and everything. And you have Stephen First as Veer in the background just looking mortified and ashamed and disgusted. But what's he doing? He's quietly witnessing this horror in front of him, as we know him to do. And this will be another motivation for him to take the actions he does in his promotion. This is the last thing he saw before he got promoted to be the ambassador to Minbar. This is the last thing he got to see. And wouldn't that make you want to do what he does go on to do?
Yes.
Because
I would hope so.
Remember when Veer was just a silly character with just bumbling, and he played Game Boy games, a little console, like his little Game Gear thing
or
at the meetings?
Sung opera.
Londo. Or got him drinks, and he was like, you are treasure, Veer.
Yeah.
And we didn't know back in the day that he was going to have interiority and be able to see things as they are, because he confronts Londo, brilliantly confronts him by saying, like, what are you doing? We've defeated them. Their cities are in ash. Their military is destroyed. We have beaten them. We have won. And Londo revealing what he's actually doing,
We have to break their pride. We have to break their souls.
Because we didn't do that last time. And we're going to
say it in a couple of different ways throughout the episode. Mm. And it like means the same thing. Like they have to utterly destroy.
Because
the Narn. Not just the planet, not just killing people. Destroying the civilization.
Their psyche, their spirit, their soul. And you know that to Londo, that's the only way to break the cycle. Because to him, it's a cycle. And as we know in the show, there's cycles of things where if we don't do it, then they'll break free again, and then we'll have to go through this again. To Londo, there is no other choices. Everything is set in stone. Everything is how it
either
has to be.
Either we win or we lose, and we need to keep winning.
And so Veer raises that this is wrong and he shouldn't be doing this, and that he had no idea that this is the level of depravity that we would sink to. And Veer shows to Londo what he says in the scene with Delenn, a younger version of himself, a man who was wide-eyed and optimistic and had yet been tainted of the cynicisms and of the horrors of the world, and
not yet cruel.
And we, as we've said, he's the angel on his shoulder, and Londo can't afford.
No,
he thinks he can't afford to have an angel. He can't afford to have somebody who's actually supporting him.
Yeah,
he
can't
must do
be
that.
Alone. He's always been alone.
And like Delenn says, it sounds like Veer is somebody you need. And that is Londo, where he is the guy who is a contradiction. He says all of these beautiful things about Londo, how he's grown fond of him. And you can see that he's being genuine there. But then when Delenn says, like, it sounds like you need him, he turns around and he just contradicts and he goes the exact opposite way, where he goes, I don't need anyone. He is a pox upon me, a stone around my neck. He just goes into that rhetoric, that mode of defense. And that's what makes Londo such a complex character. Mm-hmm. And
refusal to be vulnerable.
And it makes him feel real, because people are like that.
Yeah.
People hurt themselves, put themselves in bad positions, are cruel and mean, and go against their desires and their ideologies.
Better interests.
And their better interests. People do that.
Yeah.
People do that. And it's like, why do you do this? Why do you do this? And it's because it's a defense. It's like, well, I don't believe that things can be better, so I have to justify it. I have to justify it. I have to make it make sense. So I have to push away. And hey, here's a thing, too, that's rather interesting about having Franklin's addiction plot in the same episode here. A thing that often happens with people who are addicts, they do have that tendency to push away those who are there for them, who support.
More likely to reach out,
The support networks, they push them away, they isolate themselves, they fall into these chasms.
The knee-jerk reaction that Franklin has when Garibaldi questions him is also a reaction to that, because, like, a lot of the time, if you treat somebody that way, they won't touch the subject again.
Although Londo isn't addicted to a substance per se. I mean, we know he loves his booze and all of that, but he is addicted and he has vices, and he believes that he is stuck on this path, and he puts the blinders on in a way as well that we've seen minorly parallel to Franklin. I don't think it's a coincidence that we have these two stories intermingling with one another, but they are done in different ways. One is obviously touching upon the real world subjects of substance abuse, while Londo is talking about the condition of hubris, ego, and power driven.
And it is not a coincidence or a fault that JMS writes about for Garibaldi talking about being obsessive compulsive.
That is also something, too, because where they point that out about how Franklin and Garibaldi have these.
Franklin, that's Garibaldi, but it's also Londo, because Londo is obsessed with the idea that he is alone.
And that he is a manifest destiny.
Yes, that this is the path, and he wants to control everything into what he wants it to be, what he sees as being the necessary path forward. And then it makes it even more interesting that he's doubling down on his fate. While Jakar, in his path in this episode, surrenders his fate.
Yeah, and Londo's acts of compassion and gratitude and retribution and all of that are not selfless either. They are to motivate this trap he makes for himself. He cashes in his favor with Delenn, and not for himself, but for Via, but it's actually for himself. I need Via away from me because
he might kill Reefa, but he kills him for his own reasons.
Yeah, but
not because Reefa is a bad person.
Oh yeah, later on. But like, he uses his favor with Delenn to get Via away, not because it's for Via. Via doesn't want it. Via wants to be here, but Londo can't afford him to be here because he would convince him to do the right thing eventually. Because Via is a persuasive figure, and Via is the embodiment for Londo of himself, like this version of himself. And he can't afford to have that in his life, but also he can't afford to see Via perhaps succumb to the natures that Londo has.
He wants Via to be better than he is.
Oh, don't worry. He will be, Londo. Mm. Don't you worry. But it's just a fascinating character where we are talking about Londo. We're still leaning on like this tragedy of him, but like I said, he is
a piece of shit.
He's an absolute garbage trash fire of a man in that scene with the far, and it just
it's excruciating.
The complexities of the Londo Mollari character, where you can have all of this in the same episode, where I feel so much when he says, I miss that we don't talk, Delenn, and Delenn saying, we never really talked. And he goes, well, yeah, I guess you're right. And how there's so much happening in that exchange of dialogue where you are like, oh man, I do wish that these characters used to, like, they used to talk together. But then it is pointed out, they never actually talked about anything. It was always through the guise of politics, and through the guise business of favor and exchange. And it was always falsehood.
Over the last 2 years, to my considerable surprise, I have become very fond of Veer. Sometimes in his eyes, I see a younger version of myself before. Well, he would be better off away from here, away from what must be. He would only get in the way.
Jakar has his authority challenged again. We've seen this as a recurring thing throughout the series at this point. It's not even just once the Centauri-Narn war conflict had gone on. As stated, Nafar is the Centauri-approved representative that's come on to Babylon 5, and he's not just there to come on to Babylon 5.
Nope, he is there to kick Jakar off that station.
He's there to convince him to come home.
Drag his ass.
He's there to convince him to come back. He isn't going to take him by force.
But he will manipulate him into it. He's not going to use violence, but manipulation.
Even though he has a guy with a sword. Even though he has Talon with a sword.
Manipulation, definitely.
Is that how you see it?
Yes.
Do you think he is manipulating him to come back? Because I find Nafar a challenging presence, because I understand he is using manipulative tactics to bring him back, but I find it hard to say it with ease because he believes it.
Oh, he does. He does.
And he makes compelling points. He makes very compelling points, but there are those points that Jakar makes that completely sell you on why Jakar is the better man. But
yes,
Nafar isn't a mustache-twirling evil man who is somebody who's...
You know what I see him as being like, though?
Mm-hmm.
The diplomat from Earth that comes to sign the non-aggression treaty.
Mr. Lance.
Yeah.
But Mr. Lance was more...
I see this particular Narn as being similar to that particular human in the way of wanting the best. But also realizing that they will have to ignore things if they want that.
Right.
I see them as being in the similar yoke. Not the same character, not the same type of character, but those kind of people where they want a certain thing for a certain reason, and they are convinced that ignoring these facts and moving forward in this way is the best way forward.
Right. I think an inherent difference for me when it comes to the Mr. Lance and him is, one, privilege.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Lance has the privilege of not being subjugated or even a real target of the Centauri, but they are stopping it before it happens. I find Afar as a compelling foe philosophically for Jakar because
Really does bring up important questions for Jakar to consider.
Because we see the Narn from Babylon 5, and he does not. Nefar is there. He's been on Narn. He's seen the executions. He's seen the destruction. He is witnessing the horrible results of everything that Jakar does. The one death of them equals 500 of us. That's a number that we hear, but Nefar has seen it. Nefar has witnessed it. Nefar is aware of the people starving because Jakar is shooting down the food things and all of that. And Jakar has all these great philosophical points about freedom, about the spirit, about not being subjugated, and that all is valid. And the episode obviously agrees with that. But there is a practicality to what Nefar says.
To pay that Jakar hasn't been facing and that we haven't been exposed to as the audience.
Yes.
The reality of the resistance being dirty and awful.
Yes, and how it has unintended consequences.
Yeah.
And although it is great to, and this is what makes Babylon 5 stand out, because we can have ideological differences and debates and theories about things, about like, what do you do when you're under oppression? How do you fight? Do you fight? Is it right? And you can stroke your chin at that and go, oh, yes, I see what Jakar is saying here about how we always have to stand up for the spirit of the thing, rather. But practicality does exist, where Nefar is understanding. He agrees. He understands what Jakar is all about.
He's not saying never fight, don't fight now.
Which is also a weak excuse as well, because when is that? I mean, it's never going to be. That's the truth. And you know that, but
why let them get a stronger hold on Narn to have to try and fight back that stronger force?
Right, and this isn't going to be like last time where it was a war of attrition. They aren't going to win that way again. We know this as well, but Nefar has such a lived-in worldview that it doesn't. Like, what he says isn't invalid, where, yes, it's great to have philosophies and ideologies and all of that, but, man, Jakar, people are dying and starving to death.
The people
and
of
being tortured now, right now, right in front of my eyes.
The people of now, their lives matter too.
Yeah, and it's about lives. It's about lives, and that's what makes it difficult. Obviously, Nefar is in the wrong. The episode sides with Jakar, as it should. He's our protagonist, and the way he's willing to give himself up says so much about who he is, that he is not being motivated by pride like how Nefar thinks, like how Jakar, like how Londo thinks. It's all about pride. Jakar is evolving beyond the need for pride. We will see it be challenged throughout the series even
freedom.
More so. But it's about freedom. It's about standing up for what's right rather than being the big boy in the universe anymore. And when we get Talon in this as the security, as the bodyguard for Nefar,
it's beautiful.
It's great to see him again. And he gets a character this time. The drink that he has with Sheridan is just great. Those two actors have amazing chemistry, as we've spoken about before. And the little laughter on the rewatch of what will my higher ups think if I have a non bodyguard, and the response of being they'll say like,
there is a man who lived to be 150,
and it's like, oh, if only he won't get to live that long, will he? Maybe he would have if he had a non bodyguard with him right there.
If Talon went with him to Zaha Doom.
If he went with him to Zaha Doom, or if he fought off the Kosh fight but with a sword, that would have been fun. But Talon comes in at the end. Well, here's my problem with the Jakar story. Nafar just disappears.
Yeah. It's like, oh, wait, he's gone? That's not a problem to deal with anymore? Okay.
I love the conclusion, but Nafar does evaporate from the story off screen in a cut between scenes where Talon says, well, there is something more, and then we cut away, and then when we come back to Jakar, he's leaving and everyone's stopping him, saying that he is valued, and they convince him to stay, that he is this important person, that they are willing to have their families suffer
and
for him to leave them.
Their families are willing to do it for what Jakar stands for.
And Talon draws out that sword. Jakar is infuriated because, again, have I taught you people nothing? But Talon has his brilliant point to be made that, hey, I carry my sword in my hand, but you carry yours in your mind and your heart. And as a piece of
beautiful
dialogue that tells you about how Jakar has grown, it is probably the best. Because you would not have said that about Jakar in the first season.
Nope.
Especially in the first half, where Jakar was just the guy who had the sword in their hand. He didn't literally have one in their hand, but he was always rallying for violence, and he couldn't see beyond that. And
the amount of times he runs to go and try and kill Londo.
Or threatens the safety of Babylon 5 if Anan is harmed. But he's gone beyond that pettiness. And now he is somebody who thinks with his heart and his mind rather than with his hand. And
he's come so far.
I love the smile on his face of, I'm going to stay. And they just have that smile.
Yeah.
You just love the guy so much. And this is, again, diametrically opposed. Londo, you despise him at one point in the episode. And Jakar, you just can't help but hope the best for him. Like, Londo, I want to see him get punished. Jakar, I want to see him be saved.
Flourish.
Flourish to live a good life, to free his people, to have freedom for himself. And Londo, I just want to see him get it. And
yeah,
we
but
get
we
those
know
things.
How intertwined their fates are.
Oh, we do. We very much do.
We very much do. But even on the first watch, it's just like, yeah, Jakar will survive this. Because even on my first watch, I believed in Londo's vision.
Yes.
That's going to happen, and that's going to happen in like 20 years' time. So I was like, well, Jakar isn't going to die. But
what's he going to lose?
You sit here in exile and dream of your return in triumph, of personally driving the Centauri from our world. But this is not the time for armed resistance, Jakar. Soon, yes, but not now. We must bide our time, recover from our wounds, and lull the Centauri into a sense of false security. Surrendering. We are fighting for our world, Nafar.
It's time for the spotlight section, Rachel. The actor's spotlight, where we shine a spotlight on an actor or actress that appeared in this episode as a big or small role, one time or recurring. We look at them, what they did here, what we thought about them, what else we've seen them from, and or what else they've been in, and any interesting pieces of information. Nafar is the topic. Nafar is the guy. The actor who played Nafar is who we are going to be delving into for this one. Who played Nafar?
Stephen Macht.
It's
German. Probably still mispronounced it.
Yeah, it's one of those ones where you see it written down and you go, I'm sure that's pronounced in a way. He is Nafar. I love his performance. He is dialed in.
Yeah.
He knows how to work the makeup well. He has a very elegant voice and natural voice.
And at ease in the world as a performer.
And for a guy who's here as a one-time wonder, he's only in this one. The guy probably has never watched Babylon 5 before doing this. I don't know, maybe. But he is committed. He plays Nafar as you should, which is a man who is justified in everything they do. He plays Nafar as a man who has a life, who has experiences beyond the 45 minutes. He plays Nafar as not a wormy, sniveling, spineless character, but somebody with a different set of values.
He's not a pawn for the Centauri. He
doesn't play it like that, no. And
he's not. He's there because of the Centauri, but he is there working hard for his people.
He's probably outside of Talon and Natoth, Julie Caitlin Brown's Natoth, I should say. He's probably my favorite guest Nan.
Yeah.
Minor Nan character. He always stands out to me because we often get the Nan as this kind of savage-like race, very brutal, spiritual as well, but we don't often get to have theological, spiritual, and ideological debates between Nans like this.
A lot of that gets shifted to the Minbari.
And to the Centauri as well. Mm-hmm. The Nan don't get that as often. So Nafar allows that to be, and the actor plays with that. I say this as well. As an actor, that scene with Londo would be a dream to play. He isn't getting much dialogue, but it's the reactions and the body language. That is what you would get to sink your teeth into, and the discussion with Jakar. He, as an actor, got given great material here, and you can tell that he sunk his teeth into it.
Yeah.
There was joy to be had from an actor here. I don't know if he did enjoy himself. I have no clue. I mean, being that makeup can be a nightmare, but he came across fluid, natural to me. I always had it in the back of my brain because he has this posh voice to him. And I know it isn't, obviously, we're talking about him, but I always used to think that it was Robin Sachs, because Robin Sachs would often change up as different Nans every now and then, because he also has that prim, proper voice, but it isn't, of course. But I just had that, because again, he's so lived in, and Robin Sachs is an actor who lived in Babylon 5 in many different roles and many different capacities. What did you think of him?
I really appreciated the performance on this watch through, because I don't question him at all. I'm like, this is a Nan. This is a Nan that has lived a long life and truly and wholeheartedly believes in what he is doing, and that what he is doing is right and necessary. And it is a joy to watch. It's not easy to watch, but it's just so good that it's a joy to engage with.
Yeah, it is. I looked up the actor, and I'm not as familiar with, like, I have not seen him before in other roles. Now, I've seen some of the shows he's in, and the one that sticks out is Deep Space Nine. Now, I do remember him in Deep Space Nine a bit. He plays a Bajoran military general figure, and he has back and forth with Major Kira, and oh, wouldn't you know it, he's a bit shady, and oh, but maybe he could be better. And Bajoran drama is never my favorite thing, so I don't keep it in my brain as much. But I do remember him there, and I looked at his roles, and again, he's in Murder, She Wrote, but none written by JMS. He was in Hill Street Blues, which is the other connection. He didn't star in any episode with Peter Jurasik, and JMS didn't write for that show, but we know that the casting people would often gather from previous JMS projects or Hill Street Blues,
yeah,
for instance. So he worked there. He did some Cagney and Lacey. That's a show I'm familiar with as well. Mm-hmm. Knott's Landing. But yeah, he's just in a smattering of things. Some, like I said, Star Trek-y things. But I am not, like, outside of this role, this is... there's nothing that leaps to my mind.
No, I'm in a similar boat of he's in things that I know, but not things that I've seen. He was in an episode of Alfred Hitchcock Presents as well. He did 3 years on General Hospital.
Mm. Okay, yeah. I could see
and
that
And he did 6 episodes of Suits.
Oh, yeah. The new, like, that lawyer show.
Yeah, with... Meghan Markle.
Oh! I always forget that, yeah.
But I found the behind the scenes more fun about the suit stuff.
Oh, okay. So he had some behind the scenes on Suits.
Yeah.
Oh.
So one of the main actors in Suits is his son.
Oh, yes.
But he doesn't play that character's dad.
What does he play?
He plays a law professor. And do you know why that's fun?
Why?
Because he was / is a professor.
Of law?
No, not of law. He has a PhD in dramatic literature from Indiana University. And at various points, he's been a tenured professor.
Hmm. I also learned that his daughter-in-law is an actor. Mm-hmm. As well. She's had a long career, but not too many roles. She's an Australian. She was in an episode of Millennium, but she was the wife of the main character in the Netflix series Bloodline, which I rather enjoyed. And that was the last thing she did. She did one thing after that, and then she hasn't really done much since then. And I find that such an interesting thing. I don't know what's going on with her.
Yeah.
She probably just had other things in life. Who knows? But she was like a prominent role in a pretty big series for Netflix back in 2017 and just hasn't done much since then.
Yeah.
So I'm a little bit surprised. But she was great.
Like, this actor's work is a little bit sporadic. He seems to go through phases of focusing in on TV work. He has done very, very few films. His first thing was a TV movie in the 70s, I think it was. Did you find the TNG connection?
Yes, and I always raise my eyebrows at this because I swear I've read... this trivia point for so many actors.
Oh, they would have had they would have had a pretty long.
But it's
list.
Always the same wording, which is he was seriously considered to play the captain Jean-Luc Picard at one point. He was in the running. And it's like, yeah, how many people were in the running to play Jean-Luc Picard? It always feels like there's an easy shot of if I read male actors resume and CV and trivia that was around in this time period, they were probably up to play Jean-Luc Picard. Everybody was up for it, and they gave it to some weird English dude. some bold English guy. But no, I could see him. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if I ever could see him playing that. I could see him, you know who I'm surprised he didn't play? I could see him playing the captain of the Equinox in Star Trek Voyager. That would be an interesting role for him to play. I could see him doing that. Or, no, he's in Deep Space Nine already, but I could have seen him playing a Jem'Hadar easily as well.
Interesting.
Just the makeup, I think, is reminiscent. But that's all I've got. I don't have too much, unfortunately.
I do want to note as well, you know, surprise. The man does stage work as well.
What? You're lying. That can't be true. I don't believe you. And I don't believe you so much. I'm going to give this episode a yum yum.
Yum yum.
Yeah, that's right. It's good. Yum yum.
Out of protest for my statement?
Yes. I was going to give it that anyway, but I wasn't going to do it with my arms crossed in a pout.
I'm just wanting to be like Sheridan, honey.
Yeah, I'm in a meeting. Oh, Rachel, don't get me started about meetings. Oh, brother. Oh, boy. We can all relate, right?
No. I refuse to indulge you on that because
please,
you have one 2-hour work meeting that you do once a fucking year.
Right, guys?
2 hours. I have 2 1-hour meetings every single fucking week when I'm at work.
Yeah, but Rachel, here's the difference.
Not to mention all the unofficial meetings and briefings. Fuck you. You don't get to... No, that was one time too long.
But Rachel,
that was one time too many.
Rachel, fuck off.
It's a yum yum. Shut the fuck up and let me read the next one.
Yum yum.
Just to clarify, mine are different from yours because I have to be in a room full of 70 plus year old people bitching. Once a year feels like every day of the year with that meeting. I'll just say it. It's pretty bad. It's a pretty bad meeting.
No. I just have to be in a room full of people that I know are bitching, and a lot of them are 50 plus.
Oh.
So episode 4.
On the next Babylon 5.
Of season 3 is passing through Gethsemane.
Yes. Gethsemane, yeah.
Capital punishment has been replaced by death of personality. A mind wipe that switches a criminal's past consciousness for a new one, slash it's supposedly foolproof. But the plight of a B5 monk suggests otherwise.
A little bit spoilery in a way, isn't it, for that? But that's a Brad Dourif episode, Brother Edward, and what's that? Catholicism's at the door. Oh, brother, we can all relate, right?
You get to claim that one. I get to claim that one.
I get to claim Catholicism. Yeah. So make sure to give that one a revisit and a watch in the interim of time. But until then, you can support us on Patreon by joining it. It's at Yum Yum Podcast on Patreon. We have a plethora of content on there. We've covered new Star Trek entries episode by episode, like Star Trek Picard and Strange New Worlds. We're also going through the X-Men movies, as well as we've done the Star Trek movies, and we give our thoughts on multiple pieces of media. You get to be a part of a group Discord if you join as well, so you can talk to us and other yumlings in real time. I know, crazy stuff. We are on all of the social medias, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Tumblr, TikTok, Reddit, all of them practically. It's in the description. You can follow us on those, see some funny memes, engage with us, shout out us on there. Yum Yum Pod or Yum Yum Podcast is where we can be found. Mm-hmm. We also have a more direct way of being contacted, which is
if you want to send us an email, you can send that to yumyumpod@gmail.com.
Yeah, we like getting emails. We've been getting a couple of emails over when we were on break and just starting back up. So thank you to those people. So feel free to hit us up there, as well as subscribe and follow us on whatever podcatcher you use. We're on YouTube as well. I'd like to flag that up. We have some videos on there of the Babylon 5 trailers and TV spots. You often hear me use the TV spot voice guy for the next time Babylon 5. You get to see the full clips of those on our YouTube, as well as the morphing menus and all of that stuff, as well as episodes we upload on there. But make sure to subscribe, rate us, and review us on whatever you can. It would be greatly appreciated. But as we said, Jakar was in this episode. He had a lot of things happening. He even took his shirt off at one point. He was in his little robe. We got to see the full chest prosthetic.
But he did not say good evening to you.
He let us down.
But I will say it to you, Ryan. Good evening to you.
Good evening to you, Rachel.